Thank you very much. And my name is Hubert Klar. I'm coming from the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg, which already displays that I'm an astrophysicist. So turbulence and convection are things which I'm applying for problems in planet formation. So that's why already on my title page I introduce various images highlighting what we are doing. So here you see what we want to do is forming planets. Planets are formed initially from very tiny micron-sized dust grains, which eventually we'll have to find together. We have done simulations of these dusty gas disks around stars. We find vortices forming, and they have influence on the particles, but more about this later. Concerning the title of my talk, it's a provocative title, even if maybe you don't really feel provoked right now. Rayleigh-Bernard convection in rotating shear flows. We have the problem, or we are so lucky that we found a fluid instability, some fluid patterns forming in our accretion disks, and initially we had no idea where this comes from. Is this a numerical effect, or what goes on there? So first we talked to some geophysicists, and this is why somehow now the name global baroclinic instability or subcritical baroclinic instability got stuck to this phenomenon in the astrophysical community. But on the other hand, the more we think about, the more simulations we do, the more we see that we actually are studying here some special cases of radial convection in disk, and that's why I presented in the context here of this focus week. So as I said, I'm from the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg. Collaborators on this topic are here Natalia Rettich, who's present, Helen Morrison, Vlad Lyra, who's now in New York, Peter Bodenheimer, with whom I started this entire story. Once I was a postdoc in Santa Cruz, and of course with Anders Lund in Lund. So the outline of this talk is, of course, then the goal will be how to name this kind of instability. Maybe you can help me in the discussion phase and while you are interrupting me in my presentation, but also then in the next couple of days, so how to proceed with this baroclinic or convective baby. So we call it baroclinic instability right now. We needed a name for it, but isn't it rather radial convection? So I will roughly tell you the history of baroclinic instability in accretion disks, some fundamentals, talk about the conditions like the Brunt-Weisseler frequency as it follows from temperature and density gradients, talk about 3D structures in our flow, come to particle trapping, which then closes the loop to planet formation again, and then I'm already at my summary. I already talked in the last weeks a little bit about planet formation here. That's why I will not repeat everything again. The general picture is that if a star is forming, it also will be born with a gaseous and very dusty disk around it. So basically like a blown up Saturn's ring, but with a lot of gas and dust grains in it. So, and from this disk material, somehow we have to form our planets. About these disks, only little is known. One thing, for instance, is they have a certain lifetime with respect to the star. So what you have plotted here is that the material which is flowing from the disk onto the star, and you see here it's a rate at which with this material flows onto the star, which is like 10 to minus 8 solar masses per year, and these are here logarithmic times, so a million year, 10 million year, 100 million years, and you see that these disks are somehow accreting onto the star and in the same process disappearing. So based on this observation and the observation of this energy release in this accretion process, it was proposed that these disks must be turbulent. So there must be some inherent magnetic, turbulent processes which are rearranging the angular momentum in such a way way that the material can flow onto the star. On the other hand, if you take even the highest resolution picture of such a disk, it's just a black blob. You see roughly its geometrical shape, its aspect ratio, but you don't see any magnetic fields in it. You don't see any features of the turbulent. Not even the turbulent line broadening can be observed. So we have very little direct information on the turbulence of itself. So, but accretion disks do not only occur in the field of planet formation, so they are much older. They already came from black hole business, so where there are huge accretion rates from material flowing into the black hole, and people were trying to model the energy release from such an accretion disk. And that's why Shakura and Sunyav had a very splendid idea. They said, we have no idea what the actual turbulence looks like, but let's just parameterize it somehow locally, and saying that the viscosity is proportional to a typical typical velocity in the disk, which is simply the speed of sound, and let's take a typical length of the disk, which is the height of the disk, h, so the vertical aspect ratio, and then because this can't be completely correct, then let's simply say we are putting in a proportionality factor called alpha. So, and then for ages, people have been using this picture, simply saying that that the viscosity can be described by this one parameter, so alpha.
With the data on the left, is the best there is, or there is more of that?
Well, they are adding information to this. So why don't you like this data? No, basically. You're absolutely right. So, but the situation has only little improved. So this is really astronomical data. It has error bars. What you can say at best is you see a trend. So. But it's not much more is better. So what people
also go the opposite way, right? Almost.
Okay, let's say, so this is one part. I don't show you the other information, which tells you something about the likelihood to discover a disk in the first place around a star. And this one is very clearly correlated with age. So the older a system is, the lower is the likelihood that you're still discovering a disk. Right, and you see here these plots through here. This is not really FITS which is done so, but this is now modeling where my colleague Lee Hartman has simply applied such an alpha value and then shown that this at least is consistent with the distribution. Yes, please.
The choice of H for length scale, is there something behind that?
Well, so it's basically, it has the same function as in geophysics, the vertical height of the atmosphere, which is a very important parameter. After that, your density has dropped significantly, so you have a decoupling due to this reason. And there's a second reason. If the disk is a Keplerian shear flow, and as soon as two points are radially separated further than h, they have a sound speed as relative velocities. So basically, this then also the length over which information decouples in the radial direction. So it's a really natural quantity out of this disk.
Another question.
Yeah.
Is it clear that it's only flowing on a star, or can it be actually extending?
The precise process is actually a viscous spreading. So of course you're conserving angular momentum, which means angular momentum is transported from the inner part of the disk to the outer part of the disk, and material is flowing from the outer part to the inner part. As an effect, you have basically that a disk is getting wider and wider, and at the same time decreases in surface densities. But this is just a model. This is a process which runs over 10 million years. It has never been observed. So.
But final state.
Yeah.
It's a solar system.
Yeah.
So is it still a disk? So that's another.
In the viscous process.
Well, it's getting thinner. And,
yes.
Yeah. It is a disk. And
yes.
It extends more and more. So
a disk in the sense that it
starts to be three-dimensional. Or?
No. That's as long as you have this viscous evolution, you're maintaining the Keplerian profile everywhere. You are and you're a Keplerian as long as your H value is small in comparison to your radial extent. So, and this works nicely. And then of course the planet system is one of the end stages, and the other thing is that radiation eventually from the central object blows away the remnant gas, and then that's the end of the disk. And it's not obvious which process really sets the lifetime of the disk. Is it now the radiation or the viscous evolution, or is it just a combination of both? We usually assume that it's a combination of both. So you can now use this alpha prescription to do a very simple model for accretion disks, which was already started in the 70s, and only we updated this in 97 for some additional physical effects. What you are assuming for such a model is, or I just put it up there, is you have an accretion disk with a constant mass accretion rate. So the radial mass flux is at each radius, there's 10 to minus 7 solar masses per year. And now you can just calculate from this viscous evolution model what surface density locally has to be there in order to have this accretion rate based on a viscosity of here alpha 10 to minus 3. So basically the in first order the equation is very simple. It's simply that m dot is proportional here to viscosity times your surface density. So this means if I'm fixing the accretion rate everywhere, I'm calculating viscosity via such an approach, then I can determine what local surface density profile I have. So, and you see the surface density profile decreases radially outward, which is of course an effect that the age and in your accretion disk really increases radially outwardly, so viscosity increases radially, and so you can accrete there more. You see here distances, typical distances from the star, from a tenth of an astronomical unit distance from the sun to the Earth out to 100 astronomical units. Typical values you achieve here is now 20,000 grams per square centimeters. There's always a vertically integrated density as a place of the Earth, it's a few thousand, then just a few hundred where Jupiter and Saturn are forming, and so on. You see already here that the shape is not a power law, and this comes from the fact that the accretion rate locally, of course, releases energy. And this local release of energy leads to heating. But the temperature is now determined from the heating amount and from the cooling efficiency. And the cooling efficiency is now a complicated function of the opacity of the dust grains which are in there, which again are temperature dependent. That means for such a plot you really have to solve a vertical atmosphere model for the disk. And this is what you see here on the right side. You have here this dotted and this lower solid line, which gives you the temperatures at the surface of the disk. This is the effective temperature of the disk, like of a star. So the temperature at which radiation is being emitted. If you now, on the other hand, see the upper line, it's higher, and this is the temperature which is obtained in the midplane of the disk. Of course, in the midplane of the disk, the density is the highest, so most energy will be released in the midplane of the disk. And now the radiation has to get out of this disk. The disk is optical thick, so the mean free pass of the photons is small in comparison to the vertical extent of the disk. And this means you need a temperature gradient to diffuse your temperature from the midplane to the surface of the disk. And you see again here are these various regions of various opacities, and that's why again the midplane temperature is not simply a function of radius and surface density, but really a very nonlinear phenomenon.
But thickness changes the distance now.
Absolutely, yes.
It's not flat.
It's not flat. So you have
the profile. Can we fit this profile to this power law, saying this is just geometrically, it's getting wider? And
yeah, well, in first order approximation, h goes as r, so it radially increases, but then there are variations on this, which are linked here to this temperature profile. So, but overall, you have the case that H increases radially and sometimes even steeper than R, which means you have a flared disk. So.
And so already star is there and hitting it from inside, or
yes.
It's still out?
It's,
star
so,
is already there.
Yeah. So this is a detail here. You see here that there's a dotted line and a dashed line. So the dotted line would be the contribution of the temperature at the disk surface if it's only the viscous evolution of the disk, and the dashed line here is the heating which occurs from the central object. So you see that in the most inner part of the disk, the radiation, you know, the energy release from viscosity dominates, but starting from some radius outward, the heating from the star dominates. So it's a combination of both. So in any case, you see now that the disk has a vertical temperature gradient. We come to this again. So this was basically the plot where I stopped my last presentation here. A very popular reason for turbulence in these accretion disks are magnetic fields. So there's a magnetorotational instability, which leads to wonderful evolution here of this turbulent flows in here. So these are velocity fluctuations in the disk, and we are investigating this as well. But there's a problem with these disks, and I already mentioned the word dust grains. So there are huge amounts of small dust grains available in the disk. And these dust grains have the property that they are cleaning the disk from electrons. And if there are no electrons in the disks, then magnetic fields cannot couple to the disk gas. So that's a gigantic problem. And so people think that if you're very close to the star, dust grains evaporate at temperatures above 1400 Kelvin, so their MRI and MHD effects will be very efficient. But what happens at larger distances? So for instance, here you have a plot from Natalia Zukovic, also in Heidelberg, working on these MHD effects. Again, distances from the star, 10 astronomical units, 100 astronomical units. So this is now the vertical height of the disk, now not in absolute H values, but here in H over R, so the theta angle, so 0.1, 0.2, you see it's a relatively thin disk. Now you have this three colors in here, which indicate you whether the local region is able to connect to magnetic fields or not. So in the inner part, it's actually here resistivity which kills your MHD effects. And in the upper atmosphere here of the disk, it's ambipolar diffusion, which is another nonlinear MHD effect in which it's not the electrons which are giving you problems because they are not abundant enough, but you don't have enough ions, so there's not enough coupling again possible. So this means there will be regions in the disk which are stable, and to MHD stuff, and the question was always what happens in them. And that's why already very early on it was argued.
What is the typical magnetic Prandtl number here?
The magnetic Prandtl number that you most likely will have in disk is very small in comparison to one. So, yes.
It's around 10 to the minus 10.
Yeah.
10 to the minus 10.
Yeah. Yes. So it's really an extreme regime. So people just looked at this wonderful plot here on the right side. You see the midplane temperature is much higher than the surface temperature, and this means we have a temperature gradient in the vertical direction in this model. So wonderful. People have been calculating the Prandtl-Weierstrass frequency, and they found in the midplane it's stable. Of course, there are no gradients, but slightly above the midplane, you will have Prandtl-Weierstrass frequency, which leads to convection in the vertical direction. And this is basically where my PhD thesis started. You have here a plot from my PhD in the lower right side. So this is again the radial extent of the disk, the vertical extent, and you have these little arrows in it, which are the convection cells, which you are then producing in such a disk with the parameters as I have shown you before. So convection was for a long time a very good candidate for driving turbulence and viscosity in those disks. But there are a few problems with convection. So one, let's now call it a minor problem, is that just if you have some flows in the disk doesn't mean that you also have the proper amount of viscosity, and that also the angular momentum transport goes in the right direction. So you have in this disk really this funny case that that shear and angular momentum point in opposite direction. So the disk is rotating slower and slower if you go to larger radii, but at the same time angular momentum increases radially, because that's the property of the Keplerian profile. And this means if you simply mix locally your angular momentum, you're actually transporting it inward and not outward. So there can funny things occur. But people have been solving this problem. But now there's a second one, which is severe and was killing convection. This is, in order to have this vertical temperature gradient, you already need this viscosity prescription. And now people were able to show that even if you put in strong alpha values and a lot of heating in the midplane, the convection cells itself are not able to reproduce this heating and not able to reproduce this local viscosity. So this means it's a process which cannot keep itself alive. So convection, if you're starting in these simulations with an imposed and a starting temperature entropy gradient in the vertical direction, will transport heat out of the midplane of the disk, and once the heat is out of the disk, of the midplane in the disk, then convection is simply dead. And this was basically the end of convection. So in my thesis, we tried various things in how far having better subgrid modeling or better understanding of the processes will lead to keeping things self-sustained in convection. And then when I was a postdoc in Santa Cruz, we observed sometimes some funny events in our three-dimensional simulations of vertical convection. And this is shown here on the left side, which is a very old plot. So this is now not seen from the side of the disk. So this is again the radial direction, but this is now the azimuthal direction of the disk. So what you see here, this pressure, this density band, is now a convection cell with rising gas here somehow above the midplane. Here you have an azimuthal stretch, a zone where you have low density, and this other density region here has broken up into an anticyclonic vortex. So this was the first notion that somehow convection goes over in some other process. And now we really wondered why this happens. Is this numeric or is this physics?
I'm going to ask some simplistic question. I mean, this is all, presumably gravity has to play a role if it's anything like really Binet convection.
Yes.
And this is a self-gravitation of the disk? Or?
The gravity is just given from the central object, from the star.
From the star.
Right, but you are in a very...
In which way is it pointing?
Yeah, so...
In the plane of the disk.
Right, so basically you could say that your gravity is simply given by here, G is just given by your mass of the star divided by R squared. So this would always point then in the direction of the star.
In the right-hand figure, that is horizontal?
No, this is now vertical. So, and now I tell you why. And now the point is that the entire thing is rotating at Keplerian speed. And this means you have a correction term here, which is compensating for this, omega square r. And if you
which is the same direction.
Which points in the opposite direction.
But not in this direction.
Wonderful. Very good noted. But only in the midplane. If you now go out of the midplane.
A little bit of angle.
Exactly. And you can show that then the vertical component of gravity is just minus omega squared times z. So in the midplane, you have no vertical forces. If you go out of the midplane, then gravity increases here with z. So that's just the first order simplification of this.
And can you define some kind of a Rayleigh number for this system? If so, how big is it?
For this one, I will talk about Rayleigh numbers of the second effect. So later on, but.
No, that will not be real. Yeah. That will be a completely different number because I have gravity which is dependent on the coordinates.
So yes.
There's no g here. G is gravity acceleration is a linear function of the coordinate, which means that instead of GL you would have something other parameter L squared, something like that.
Yeah. So
the unknown, but not the really numbers.
I will mention this. Friedrich Busse and I were starting last week to derive some Rayleigh numbers for this, and it's quite nicely possible. I will show this a little later. So, basically, we have the Pfund-Weisseler frequency. We just have to divide it by viscosity and thermal conduction. So.
The idea is take your G and replace it by omega squared times the H. That would be zeros
Right. And of course, then it's a function of height from the disk because that goes in there. So, but you can do this. Yes.
Omega squared height from the disk.
Right. Yes. H. Correct. Yes. And. So we saw that the vertical and Pfund-Weisseler frequency cannot help you a lot. So, but now people helped us that it's actually radial effects which you have here. So again, I'm defining here already a Pfund-Weisseler frequency n squared for the disk, and putting in typical disk values, you find the following thing. So it's everything is proportional to 1 over this adiabatic coefficient. This is replaces basically the expansion coefficient for our compressible gas. We have here this pressure scalar of the disk h over r squared. You have here 2 beta values. Beta s is the entropy gradient. Beta p is the pressure gradient. And again, omega squared. And based on this, you can show that whenever entropy gradient and pressure gradient are pointing in the same direction, radially outward, then you will have a negative square of the Pfund-Weisseler frequency. So the pressure gradient here actually replaces gravity in the system, because again, actually, you would assume that in the midplane of the disk here, the gravity of the star and the centrifugal acceleration compensate each other. But this is not entirely true, because as we have seen before, the radial pressure and density in the disk decrease. And this means we have an additional correction here, which is here proportional to the
next line, because some people will see.
So I put it again here. So G in the radial direction is then given by proportional to this minus m over r squared plus omega squared times r, and now we have also an additional force pushing radially outward, which is a pressure gradient, which is then 1 over, let's now call it the surface density gradient here, gradient p. So, and this means that in our assumption for now the Pfund-Weisseler frequency, as those terms basically cancel, the radial gravity is just replaced by this radial pressure gradient, and this comes basically so the radial gravity is just the mismatch between the subkeplerian gas motion and the attraction of the star. So that the gas disk is rotating at a rate slightly lower than the keplerian value, and exactly this residual gives you the radial gravity for this thing.
So what's the name you keep on using for the frequency?
Pfund-Weisseler?
Sorry?
Pfund-Weisseler.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, and this can be translated into a Richardson number where you are just dividing the Pfund-Weisseler frequency by the shear in order to see whether this convection, which would follow out of the Pfund-Weisseler frequency, is able to fight against the radial stabilizing forces. And those is angular momentum, and this is the shear. And the Richardson number indicates you that you are not in a linear unstable regime for this entire thing. So, for instance, the first thing, of course, we did was from the Pfund-Weisseler frequency to calculate the Solberg-Hyland criterion, which tells you whether it's possible to have convection in the radial direction in a system. This was derived for convection in stars, and based on this, we found no radial convection is possible. The rotation is too stabilizing for this entire thing. And also, we find that the Richardson number, it's plotted here. It is negative for a large portion portion of the disk. So this means it is in the unstable regime, but any value larger than minus one means that any instability is killed from the shear and simply died out. Okay, this is the next one here. But right, we come again to this plot. So in fact, what we
by a rotational profile.
Yeah, exactly. So this I have to show you this historic simulation from 1999, which is only preserved because it was scanned in here from KITP when I was giving a presentation pretty much on this topic here. So when I was a postdoc in Santa Cruz, again you see the situation here from 3.5 to 6.5 astronomical units, 90 degrees, and what is plotted here is vorticity, and you find that here these anticyclonic vortices have formed in this simulation. When we were trying to understand this phenomenon, we came across some geophysicists, and they all told us about baroclinic instability, that there are similar vortices forming in the Earth's atmosphere. That's, I just mentioned this briefly to you to show you where all the name comes from here, from the thing. So the idea, what we initially proposed is then you have heating of the rotation of the Earth at the equator, the North Pole is being cooled down, and you would now have convection cells if the Earth would not be rotating. Rotation is stabilizing the thing, so you have basically the same situation as in an accretion disk, so that the rotation is preventing you from simply having radial convection, or in this case, convection between the equator and the North Pole. So what the Earth's atmosphere is doing is that you get this baroclinic instability, so that has, you have a decoupling of various vertical layers, and you're forming these low-pressure cyclones and high-pressure anticyclones in the atmosphere. And when we saw some of the experiments done in this field, where geophysicists do not even consider a spherical surface, but just a disk structure, then we thought, oh, this must be really something similar as what we see. So here you have cold water in the center, warm water in the outer side, it spins, and then you see all funny patterns in here. It simply looked too nice in comparison to what we found in our simulations that we could resist to say that it's also a baroclinic instability. So here you see for low instability you find axisymmetric pattern, and later you find these wonderful M modes, and of course I think many of you have seen these experiments. So we have this water tank in the middle, it's cooled here, it's heated in the outer part, so the entire thing is rotating, so the camera is rotating with the entire thing, that's why you don't notice it, and this guy is not running around the thing, but he's standing, so just tripping things in. And you see here, yeah, and you see then how this color is being put in, and you see here this wonderful patterns, jet streams which are forming, vortices, and one property here is, of course, what you have to see is that even the rotation is pretty fast of the system, the resulting flow velocities are pretty small. And that's a similar situation as with our disks. So the rotation speed of our disk has a Mach number of roughly 20. So 20 times the speed of sound is the rate at which our disks are rotating. And on the other hand, the typical velocities of whatever flow we see are just a few percent of the speed of sound. So there's a huge discrepancy in these mean velocities.
Is that related with the low value of alpha that you have to put in, the viscosity?
That's
an argument that uses dimensional analysis, and every time you have to put in a number that's 10 to the minus 3, that seems a little...
Yeah, so it's not related to the alpha value, but it's related to the value h. So h is basically the ratio between h to the radius is basically the inverse Mach number of the flow. So in order to have a thin disk, the speed of sound has to be small in comparison to the Keplerian velocity. Otherwise, it's not a disk anymore. So it comes already from the assumption of h.
But in this experiment, I mean, the fluid itself is incompressible. What is the speed of sound? Is the speed of surface waves?
Then you have to look at the Rossby waves. No, it's the internal gravity waves. And they are very slow, so.
Okay. relativity is also kind of asymptotically the speed like g times square root of gh, which is the...
Yes, but it's then rho 1 minus rho 2, so this this makes them extremely slow, so... Right, so baroclinic instability in disks, so I always worry about it. So it's a local instability picking up on the global radial entropy gradient in the disk. And here I said in sign unimportant, which only means that as long as pressure and entropy point in the same direction, you will have this instability. It can also be reversed. If you have the disk where entropy and pressure are radially increasing, again, the same instability would work. Logic is that it's closer to the star, it will be warmer. And if we switch off rotation and shear, then we have convection in the system. So we are observing here basically a convection which is modified by the two stabilizing agents, which is shear and rotation. And to show you how our local simulations look like, that's the one Vladimir Lyra has been provided. It's here a patch of the disk, radial direction, azimuthal direction. What he is plotting is vorticity. You see initially there were some small seed vorticities being put in here. You see here these black dots. Now these are all anticyclones. Cyclones, by the way, are not possible in the disk because the shear would kill them. So whatever vortices are being formed in here are anticyclones. And these very similar simulations have been performed before without this radial Prunt-Weisseler frequency with an isothermal gas. And in this case, vorticity is conserved and viscosity was slowly destroying the vortices, which means you were starting such a run and after some time no vortices were left over. So, but here you see these vortices are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So they are really picking up from the entropy gradient. When they are closer to the star, they are being heated up. They move out, cool down, and transport in this way entropy in the radial direction. And you're forming here.
Yes.
Sorry?
This
is a two-dimensional simulation.
So
correct.
It's radius. I mean, the radius is from zero to the end, and this is azimuthal.
And this is the azimuthal direction, correct?
The left side they go up and the right side they go down.
Yes, so this is basically a disk which is in the co-rotating frame. So the middle of the box here goes at the Kepler speed around the star.
I see. Okay.
And this is the velocity in which we are plotting this. And we are also using this shearing box approximation, which means anything which is leaving here to the left comes back from the right side, but compensated for the shear.
It seems non-stationary. You first had a lot of small vortices.
Yeah.
Now you have big vortices, like you have kind of inverse cascade.
Yes, right. Absolutely right. Yes. So we see that they are merging. And eating up and getting stronger and stronger.
It's all almost system-sized vortices now.
Yes.
You need a bigger box.
Huh?
You need a bigger box to simulate.
Yeah. We are discussing this.
It's here.
Yeah, but it's also will be different. So this is a very idealized case because it's a local simulation. So it's a confined region. In 3D it looks different, and also in 3D when you have vertical stuff, I will show this later, than the of other limiting factors. But now one thing which is very similar to radial convection is that they are transporting entropy radially outward. And one thing which is clearly different than what you find in convection is a problem, and this is I want to explain you here. So
you can use also the right side.
Yeah, okay, I will do so now.
I can switch on lights there.
Okay. So in thermal convection, you're basically starting from an infinitesimal perturbation, and then the entropy gradient and the buoyancy will take over and form something out of this. This is not possible in these cases because the shear is so strong. If you put in this instability case a linear perturbation, a small perturbation, it's simply dying out due to the shear. So and shear is really what kills everything in this disk. The only feature which is able to survive the shear flow is a vortex. And not just any vortex, but only very special vortices, which are called, as one simple approximation, Keeler vortices. And the idea here comes basically, Sean, from even before hydrodynamics. It's basically if you have a point moving around your star here, then at the Keplerian speed, then you have either the solution that you are moving on a circle, or you have the possibility that you're moving on an ellipse. So you have here a second point, and this is moving now on an ellipse. Then this looks like this. So the famous invention of Mr. Kepler to use ellipses for the paths of planets. And if you're now going in the local system, so just taking here a local system, you take again the first body, then the path of the second satellite here looks basically like a little circle, a little ellipse. No, it's an ellipse of aspect ratio 1 to 2. Let's put it this way, around the first body. So these are the infamous epicycles. So they were trying to approximate Keplerian stuff with. So, and the property of the motion along this ellipse, of course, is here, as you see already from this plot, is also omega. So basically, you're orbited by something by omega. So you can now go to the pressure-free case in hydrodynamics, and then you see that this epicycle here must be a solution which completely fulfills your hydrodynamic equations. So this has to be then a little bit fiddled around. You can also then check for cases where there is pressure involved, that there is a pressure maximum, and then you find that the vortices are not rotating at Keplerian rate anymore, but a certain fraction of it. But the important point is that even the smallest vortex already needs a significant fraction of the Keplerian frequency to rotate. So even the most elongated, if they rotate slower, then they are getting just elongated and get weaker. Even they are then still rotating at 50% of the Keplerian speed. So, and this means you really have to introduce already a vortex. You cannot simply wait what kind of convection cells will form. So there is already basically a kind of pipe system set by the Coriolis forces. So the fluid path is already defined from the dynamics of the disk, from gravity and epicyclic motion. And then convection cannot just form freely structures, but can only amplify these vortices or not. So if you look, for instance, for the density structure, just to show you how such a simulation looks like in more detail, if you look for the density structure, then you see mostly waves, so propagating. So again, radial and azimuthal direction. So these are also eigenmodes of the disk. So these are density perturbation. They are radially propagating, something like shear modified sound waves. But they are always decaying again, always have to
be generating again. Do we understand this? This is the
yes.
By speed of propagation? Or
yes, this is basically coming from your shear. So, okay. Right. So these are very typical modes. They also look the same if you do MHD turbulence or whatever in the disk. The same run, if you look for the vorticity, you see here such a vortex which has formed, and you see again how the waves are propagating across this. And it's basically the vortex which is emitting these waves by its perturbation. So actually, I'm now cheating here in order to have this on this landscape property. Actually, the vortices are very slender. So if you do to their true aspect ratio, it's like 1 to 4. And this is really important. If they would have a smaller aspect ratio, they would be easier subject to parasitic instabilities and break apart. So which is a limit.
The vorticity inside compared to the shear outside, what is the ratio?
This was taking me some time. So the vorticity of the background flow is plus 1/2, and the vorticity in the vortices go down to -1. So it really changes sign. So
yeah, but it's twice there.
Yes, correct. Yes. So So roughly a list of publications. You can talk to me about this later. I want to show you some more interesting results before the time over. It's only every couple of years there was some contribution of it. The huge discussion whether it's a numerical effect. I just want to highlight here a paper in 2007 from Peterson, Stewart, and Julian. Glenn Stewart was helping me a lot to show the importance of thermal relaxation in this entire process in order to drive the instability. So, and this, I will come to this later. And Lisieux Papaloisou, this was really important, this paper, because they were some of our strongest criticists on this work, and they finally also confirmed the findings. Okay, and Vladimir Lyra, I will show a plot of his. He's always very fast and ambitious to introduce new physics. He's already studying the interaction between magnetic fields and these vortices. So one property we saw from our simulations is that if we are again measuring the alpha value as a proxy for the strength of our turbulence, then we see the higher our resolution is for the same other parameters, the stronger is our instability. And if we go to really low Reynolds numbers or low resolution, sorry?
What is N here?
N is here just the resolution. The number
it's
of bit cells. This is still 2D.
2D,
yes. And this means if we are going to low resolution, then all the instability dies, which is a good sign that it's not a numerical instability. Your instability is nonlinear, which means you need resolution, you need larger Reynolds numbers. And then eventually you find here some settling, and these resolution studies are done by Natalie, so I'm really curious how this will converge. Of course, this is very trivial. Beta, again, is our entropy and pressure gradient, and you see the stronger these gradients are, then also the stronger your alpha values will be. And this is actually here the ballpark of values which is used in modern accretion disk simulations, 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 2, so it could work. And now there comes something which was unexpected. And this also shows you a huge difference to the approach with the Rayleigh number. Again, here the strength of the turbulence measured as values of alpha. And here I have the thermal relaxation time, tau c, the cooling time, with respect to the orbital period. And then you see that, very interestingly, in the isothermal regime, where you have instantaneous cooling, you are killing the instability, and also in the adiabatic regime. So. The idea here is really that on the orbital frequency of the vortex, and we said that it's roughly omega, independent of its size, it has to be cooled and heated. And this is obvious, because if you have a vortex, so basically here your flow, which is already confined in this tube by the Coriolis forces, you have the hot region and you have the cold region, then basically you already have defined it must be rotating at omega. And in order to have now in your flow direction here gas transport entropy in this part and entropy in the lower entropy material in this part and the inner part, you need this a phase here in the inner and in the outer part of the disk, closer to the star and further away, in order to do your thermal readjustment. So if this thermal readjustment does not occur, then your convection will die. So we do not have the comfortable situation where there's interaction with some plates which are hot and cold per se, but you have to readjust to the background flow. And at the same time, you have already described the path. And this is why it's so important for this instability to have here a thermal relaxation time or a thermal diffusion, which is giving you this effect, which is on the order of the orbital period. So, of course, different sized vortices, they all have the same frequency, I said, but of course they have all different cooling times. And then things are changing again, so that also for longer cooling times one can work. if one would now, and this is what we did last week, Friedrich Busse and I, so we were starting to define a Rayleigh number, which then turns out to be the Grund-Weisseler frequency times our typical dimensions of the system, which we took again to be h to the power of 4 divided by viscosity and then the thermal diffusivity kappa, gives us very nice numbers for our preferential runs, which is in the order of a few thousand. So we are in the right parameter range to have indeed Rayleigh-Bernard convection in the radial direction. But if I'm now playing around with the thermal diffusivity and make it smaller and smaller, the Rayleigh number would tell me now that convection gets stronger and stronger. But here you see if I'm making kappa stronger and stronger, the thermal relaxation time gets smaller and smaller, and the entire instability will eventually die out. So this is basically the latest on what we have done in theory of this thing. So we have to understand more how to have a better prescription for these vortices. So
I mean, the Rayleigh number n is this
Grund-Weisseler frequency. It's
You measure your alpha by angular momentum transport or by mass transport? How you actually measure your alpha?
By angular momentum transport.
Angular momentum?
So it's basically I'm measuring the turbulence, the Reynolds stresses.
So it's viscosity.
Yeah. The mass transport does not occur because we are calculating locally.
Uh-huh.
So we can only measure the stresses. Good. So this is a simulation. I was asked about 3D stuff. So three-dimensional simulation, it is vertically stratified for pressure scale height in the vertical direction. If you just look at vorticity, it looks like in pretty much like in 2D. Vortices are maybe slightly smaller. You see that this is now the density structure in 3D. You see it's still pretty much two-dimensional. Even it's vertically stratified, you see that these are basically just upwellings and downwellings. It's not three-dimensional turbulence here, but it's really 2D waves which are propagating in this 3D system. Again, these wonderful density shear waves in here. If you go to other heights, you always see the same flow pattern, density pattern. So it's really a 2D wave, which is just like on the ocean, running forth and back. You can also look how an equidensity line looks like. And then you see here roughly the surface of the disk. So it will just look like the ocean, where all these waves are running forth and back. If you now look how the vortices in the same run look like, in the density you would never find them, because they are only small deviations from the background density, as I said before. So if you now look for the vortices, then you see again they are vertically extended blobs. In this particular run, we only start to do 3D cases, they have a minimum around the midplane, and once you are more than one pressure scale height away from the disk, everything gets a little bit fuzzy. So of course densities drop down and physical parameters change. So these are our convection cells in 3D. So this is really the midplane. So I just blend in where the midplane is. And then you see also this is again vorticity, which is plotted, which shows you of course the surface of the vortex, but it also shows you now all these wonderful Rossby waves in the system. So perturbations in vorticity which are propagating. How strong will alpha be eventually? We will have to see. It's really a question on realistic beta values. We are checking out what happens for low entropy gradients, and we find that still we do not have in many cases a necessary Reynolds number. So we talked about already the importance of the Richardson number for this effect. We can confirm that when we have this Richardson numbers of 3 times 10 to minus 3, we are for really realistic disk parameters for a large region in conditions where such cooling should such instability should occur. Another important criterion is the cooling time, as I said, the thermal relaxation time. So I'm plotting here the thermal relaxation time in units of the local Capelian frequency, and you see it's somewhere in the ballpark between 10 and 100, which is quite possible for the instability. the Prandtl number of the system is really, again, a very crazy number. So you only have molecular viscosity, which is extremely low. On the other hand, you have very efficient heating and cooling, which is not a thermal diffusion, really, by contact, but it's radiation transport. So it's really that gas talks to the dust, and the dust sends out a photon half through the disk, where it's being reabsorbed again. That's why, yeah, then you have, again, Prandtl numbers in the order of 10 to minus 10 or so. So really a crazy regime. I just want to mention, Vladimir Lyra has been looking into the interaction between vortices and magnetic fields and finds that, especially what I found interesting, in cases where magnetic fields are too weak to start turbulence, the vortices can twist up the field lines in such an interesting way that suddenly all hell breaks loose and eventually magnetic fields will take over. I come to the...
Simulations are not at Prandtl number of 10 to the minus 10.
No. So the typical Prandtl numbers we have are like 10 to minus 2. This is what we can achieve in the code. So, but we would like to have more, right? We also do global simulations. Again, you see here, really a disk, and you see here such a nice red blob. Here it's a blue blob formed like on the surface of Jupiter. Again, very last thing that I will talk about today is vortices are also particle traps. So, and this is for two reasons. First, they are high-pressure regions, as I explained to you before, because they are rotating slightly.
Because they're anticyclones.
Anticyclones, and with this precise aspect ratio. If they would have an aspect ratio of 1 to 2, they would not be pressure traps. So then they are just rotating too fast. So it has to be in an intermediate regime. But anticyclones, right. I'm almost done. Perfect. And so it's a high-pressure region. You can also see this capturing as, again, the effect here of this epicyclic motion of particles. Because a particle, a solid, does not feel the pressure and, of course, wants to move on the epicyclic motion around the point. But if the vortex is rotating slower than epicyclic, it loses angular momentum and moves also to the center. So, very interesting. So, and this is a simulation here by Natalie Rettich, where she has thrown a lot of small dust here. So it's small is what we call 20 centimeters. So you have to be coupling to the fluid nicely on the largest scales on the Keplerian-Stokes number regime, and you find here how these colors, the white is extremely large, like a factor of concentration in 1,000. How things are getting concentrated. Is this the right movie with the Stokes number? I have confused them. Good that you are here. Thanks, Nadine. So, okay, so this is then I think the really large ones. Okay, so these are particles which have a Stokes number which is even larger than coupling to the largest flows. But even those get very gently being shaken around and are forming these wonderful streams in here.
But how do the particles evolve?
So in this case, they are just being carried along from the gas.
No inertia, I mean.
No, but yes, they have inertia, yes,
this is,
right.
So you solve the equation for particles.
Exactly,
right.
Yes, correct. So then we have to see what happens at other particle sizes. So, Natalie, which particle size?
Particle size means different Stokes number.
Exactly, yes. So you can rescale this again then to other radii.
That's
so they are nicely captured.
What we are supposed to see.
Okay, so this would be now the Stokes number of 1 with respect to the large scale motion.
Wait, that's exactly the same video as before.
Oh.
This is
then I did this mistake. Okay.
Is the Maxwell-Rayleigh equation or what did you solve?
It's just the Stokes plus Stokes friction. It's just.
Yeah.
But this must be right.
That's right.
So I was talking about this part before. So which one particle size is this?
That's the correct one, the small ones.
Okay, good. And then you see how things...
Small
Stokes and small particle size.
But that's how small the Stokes here.
0.05,
it's up there.
So this is the correct label?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
The number is calculated with respect to the Keplerian frequency.
Exactly, yes.
It's
sorry?
The color code?
The color code tells you about the density. The white would be 1,000, red is then somewhere 10 or 100. So over density, concentration factor, correct, yes. And then you find how things are getting...
So red means that many particles.
Yeah. Exactly, yes.
This is where planets would appear, no?
I show you in the next thing. So the first thing which you should notice here is that once your concentration gets very large, you have a lot of feedback from the particles to the gas, and this destroys the vortex in part.
You mean
you have to do this, because as soon as you have as much gas in there as you have particles, things become unstable.
But what's the density of the particle as compared to the fluid?
10 to minus 9. So they are 10 to the 9 denser in their density, or what do you mean?
The density ratio. The density of the particle as compared to the density of the fluid.
Yes, like 10 to 10.
So 10 to the 10 times higher concentration.
No. The material density. I thought this is what you mean.
The material. It's solid, and the gas is very dilute.
Yeah.
But I mean, why do they go to the vortices then? I mean, they should be, because of inertia, they should be thrown out of vortices, just as in turbulence.
Ah, see, this is all the part which...
If you have particles in turbulence, they are heavy particles.
Yes.
In turbulence, they are thrown out of the vortices.
This is absolutely right if you are not in the geostrophic regime.
That's high pressure.
So we are in the geostrophic regime, where all our pressure gradients are in equilibrium with the Coriolis forces. So this means we are in a regime of very low Rossby numbers. So rotation is very important. And this means that particles try to concentrate in pressure maxima. So this is just the opposite to...
Vortex is always low pressure, and particles go outside. Here vortices are high pressure. Because there are vortices with respect to this overall rotation.
Mm-hmm. So, right, and eventually you see this was a run where you also have gravity included to this entire thing, and then you see how wonderful little clumps are forming. So they are now in the planetesimal size, which is you're forming asteroids out of this entire stuff. And
so, does the time scales of self gravitation and formation of these vortices?
That's
roughly comparable then? Is that...
Obviously, the time scale for the formation of vortices.
Right.
This should be done in a few hundred, maybe a few thousand orbits.
That's very fast compared to that self-gravity.
If it works, yes. And self-gravity works really on a few dynamical orbits.
Oh.
So otherwise, shear again would destroy it, so it has to be fast. And this is just my last transparency, and what I wanted to point out here is, as we still have not understood, there are a lot of open questions about this baroclinic instability, or maybe just Rayleigh-Benard convection. There will be a meeting at Ringberg in Germany, at this castle of the Max Planck Society, from June 14th to 18th, with the topic of geophysical and astrophysical fluid dynamics. So there we really want to have interaction with the engineering people doing on particles and fluids, and with people doing meteorological studies and oceanography, and really see more on this instability. Right, exactly. So thanks a lot for your interest, and if you have more questions, I'm around.